History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're educated, we're always entertained, and yes, we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Our focus this week will be the USS Indianapolis, a ship that played such a critical role in World War II, but in all the years since has become best known for its tragic ending. Ultimately, just 316 men survived after the ship was sunk just after midnight on July 30th, 1945, and today there is only one left. He was the youngest man aboard. And Harold Bray recently celebrated his 99th birthday. You'll hear his memories in a bit. But we'll start by focusing on one of the 879 who did not survive what has become known as the worst sea disaster in the history of the U.S. Navy. If you've never read the best-selling book Indianapolis by Sarah Vladeck and Lynn Vincent, I can't recommend it enough. Not to mention Sarah's documentary, USS Indianapolis, The Legacy. The official website, ussindianapolis.com, is the best source of accurate information, and there are so many links there for you to browse. It's been nearly a decade now since a research team led by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen discovered the wreckage of the ship that had delivered components of the atomic bomb to the island of Tinian before being sunk by a Japanese submarine. That was in 2017 that the Indy was found, 3.5 miles deep in the Philippine Sea. And that's when I spoke to someone who shares my name, Paul Leffler. In this case, Paul Leffler III, a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel from Alabama's Gulf Shore, whose father, Paul Leffler Jr., was one of those 879 who perished 81 years ago this week.
Well, I have a vague memory of my father, and one of the memories is that when they were hit in the strike in Okinawa and they came back to San Francisco for repairs, he came home at that time. And I have a vivid memory of that time when he was here. We actually took a professional family photograph of the four of us, the family. He was not in uniform. He was in a suit. And I remember all that. And my grandfather had a house on Mobile Bay, and we went down there. And I do remember that part of it. Now, I had a really great childhood. My mother never remarried. I had a brother that was a year younger than me. And I really didn't have any emotion about my father until I became older and realized what my mother had gone through, which was the news was given to the families that she had been sunk the same day VJ Day was, when everybody was euphoric about the end of the war. And then she got this telegram that he was missing in action. And then I understood what kind of suffering that she went through for that to happen to her. So those were kind of the emotions that I had when I was growing up, and I never wanted her to have to go through anything like that again, were my feelings about it at the time.
And what about trying to learn more about your father or what he did on the ship or what happened to the ship? Was that something that you were always interested in, or did you stay away from it?
No, what happened was sometime in my 20s, when I was, graduated from the Citadel and had gone on active duty. I mean, my mother had always, we'd always had news clippings and that kind of thing around the house, you know, so I knew a lot about it, but I didn't seem that interested in it. I always considered him a hero and all that kind of thing. And that's why I think I went into the military. There was a doctor who was on the Indy who survived. And I think he wrote the first book that I'm aware of about the sinking. And my mother gave me the book. And once I read that book, that's when I became somewhat interested in it and what happened to the people who were on board. The fact that he was missing in action and nobody could ever tell my grandfather, what happened to him, was the main focus that I had, was that, you know, nobody could tell anything about him, what happened to him. He was on the bridge, his watch was over at midnight, and they hit right after midnight. I had the last letter that he wrote my mother, and he wrote it from the ship when they had sailed from San Francisco to deliver the bomb. And in that letter, he talks about one of his good friends. Now, he was 28 years old, so his friend had to be older, around the same age, because his friend had a father who was a commander in the Navy, and they had dinner with this friend's father, who was the commander, and I located his name to see if he knew anything about my father, and he also did not survive. So there was really nothing that anybody could tell me, so I really didn't do much about it after that, because nobody could tell me anything. Mm. So what happened was, when the ship was discovered Saturday, it was just a huge surprise, because I didn't know anybody was even looking for her. Mm. And I was so surprised and excited. I was getting ready to go pick up a sister-in-law from the Mobile airport who was coming in from Michigan. And I'm getting everything together, and I just received, I think it was on Facebook, and I walked out without my keys and locked myself out of the house.
Oh, no.
Because it was so exciting to me and so surprising. Those were the first emotions that I felt. And then on the way to the airport, you know, I felt this. They were all positive emotions, no negative emotions at all. I felt this euphoria that she had been discovered. I felt this joy. I was in awe. I was relieved. I was, all these things were running through me. And I think I'm different from a lot of the other people who were on the Indy, because of the fact that my father was MIA and we never knew what happened to him. So to me, it was such a relief that the ship had been found, and that then you throw hope into that emotion because he may be still there. We never knew whether he got off the ship, whether he went down with the ship. And so that's why these emotions came to the surface. You know, I had no idea that people were looking for sunken warships. I don't know why I missed that. You know, I know I've trying to remains of pilots and soldiers and that kind of thing. I'm aware of all that, but I never knew that anybody was out there looking for sunken U.S. warships. Just didn't know about that. Mm-hmm. And I just figured, you know, I'd go to my grave at some point, not knowing. But I feel at peace because we know where the ship is now. And I don't know how long DNA survives. I think sometimes it survives for 8 million years if it's protected. So his DNA is probably somewhere on there, and we share the same DNA. So that brings me a semblance of peace about all of this.
Sure. And I don't know if you have an answer for this or not, but when you say you didn't know what happened to him, I mean, what you mean is his watch was over, so you don't know where he went. From there, was he above deck or below deck when they were hit? Did he get off the ship? Was he in the water? Did he get eaten by sharks, as so many did in that disaster? Or was he below deck and somehow still on that ship? And I guess it's conceivable that his dog tags or other possessions of his could potentially be recovered down there.
Yeah, those are all the questions that are out there and are answered. As I said, he was a seaman. He was the quartermaster on the bridge, and his watch was over at midnight. Now, I know that his quarters were below deck, but my mother told me that he used to sleep. It was so hot in that part of the Pacific that a lot of the sailors would sleep on deck, which he would also do. So we don't know, as I said, whether he was still there. He was going below. He was below where he was when they were hit.
And Paul, you said your father's Navy background was a motivating factor in your choosing to serve our country?
I believe that was the main impetus for me to join. and to volunteer. There's an aside that I haven't told you. My father was in the Navy. His younger brother parachuted into Normandy with the 101st Airborne. Now, when you look at those two people, statistically, my Uncle Robert should have been the one to perish in the war. But he survived, and my father did not. And my Uncle Robert told me stories about parachuting in Normandy and what they did and all that. And I had all that history from that side of it. So I think that's why I chose to go to a military college and receive a commission and follow through on that. And I've never had any regrets in any of that in my life. There's another interesting side to this story. If you've got a little bit of time, I can tell it.
Go for it.
Peter Benchley wrote the book Jaws. And I read the book. I was living in Chattanooga, Tennessee at the time. And in the book Jaws, there's a character named Paul Loeffler.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew at the time there were only 1,200 heads of households in the United States with the name Loeffler spelled with that spelling, the L-O-E-F-F-L-E-R. And I thought, well, that's a little bit weird, but I didn't think anything of it. The character owned a delicatessen in the town where the event took place. So read the book, enjoyed the book, and then the movie comes out. And Peter Benchley was the screenwriter for the movie. And in the movie, they have a scene where they're talking about the sinking of the Indianapolis. And I'm sitting there with the hair standing up on the back of my neck. Because my dad, Paul Loeffler, was on the Indy. Peter Benchley didn't mention the Indy in the book, but mentioned it in the movie. And Paul Loeffler was in the book, but not in the movie. So I contacted Peter Benchley. I was able to find him, find his information for New York, send him a letter and all that. And he sent me a short little note about he had known many men of the sea. All characters in this story are fictitious. And I was just interested in how he came about, the name and all that kind of thing.
I want to thank you for your service to our country and for helping us understand something that no one else could, you know, what it was like to grow up with this knowledge and then the quest to learn about your dad. And now, as you described it, this euphoria of finding out that there might be more developments to come, that his ship has been found. I know that you've talked to a lot of people about your father over the years. You've done a lot of things to honor his legacy. What is his legacy in your mind? How do you articulate that? What does his memory and his story mean to you?
Well, he's part of that greatest generation who saved the United States, and I'm proud of that fact. I'm proud of the fact that he died in service of the United States. His photo with his medals and that kind of thing and a something from President Truman about the Indy and his name on that, signed by President Truman, is hanging in the Fairhope American Legion Hall in a place of honor. I saw that was done. At his school, University Military School in Mobile, where he graduated from in 1935, they also have that same photo of him, the World War II medals, and the President Truman document. So I've tried to keep his memory alive by doing things like that. And I'm just proud to be his son, and that's where I come from on that. At my family plot at Catholic Cemetery in Mobile, I do have a military headstone for him, even though he's not there, and it says, "Still at sea," which he is. He's still at sea.
Someday I hope to visit that marker in Fairhope, Alabama. And when I do, I'll also go by the Alabama State Veterans Cemetery, because less than a year after learning that his father's ship had finally been located, Paul Loeffler III finished his journey on Earth. The family members of the Indy's final crew for years have held reunions, and even after all these years, new information continues to come out. I'll again recommend that you visit ussindianapolis.com to dive deeper into this incredible tale. And when we come back, memories from two of the 316 who survived, including the only one still with us. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode dedicated to the saga of the USS Indianapolis, which 81 years ago this week delivered components of the atomic bomb to the island of Tinian, only to be sunk by the Japanese submarine I-58 on its return voyage. One of the 316 men who survived out of a crew of nearly 1,200 was a teenager from Arizona named Adolfo Celaya, known as Harpo to his crewmates because of his curly hair that evoked Harpo Marx. We'll pick up his memories on the evening of July 29th, 1945.
I had gone to, in my compartment, they had some vents that bring air down. And it was very hot in those days, and I had gone to sleep down there below, but I had my crew chief, which came down looking for me and came over and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Why don't I go up on top deck?" He said, "And our watch goes from 4 to 8. He said, "We can wake each other up." And so I went with him, and we went up. But there wasn't a place upstairs that you could lay on. It was, all the sailors were upstairs because it was very hot. But I remember I always used to sleep with a blanket on. Everybody used to make fun of me because I did that. But I was got used to it, and my crew chief was laughing at when we went to bed. And that's where I was when they repeated it. The big explosion happened right where I was at. The thing that saved me was a blanket that I had on, because when I woke up, there was no blanket. The fire had taken it off.
Were you burned at all?
I had burns on my legs and my hands, where I had my hands out, but my hair was almost all gone. My eyelashes were gone there. Then. So it was a pretty good-sized blast, and it killed a lot of sailors around me. The only thing that saved me, I think, was the blanket.
Well, this was just 4 days after you guys had gotten to Tinian with that important cargo.
Yeah.
Of course, and you still didn't know what that was. But what a way to wake up with your hair burned off, your eyebrows burned off, the blanket blown off of you. And that ship, this huge cruiser with 1,200 men on board, sunk in just 12 minutes?
12 minutes.
What was that 12 minutes like for you?
Well, I ran to the back of it, and then that's where I met with my friend Santos Peña. I didn't have a life jacket. I didn't have anything with me. In fact, I only had my T-shirt and my shorts. I didn't have shoes. I have nothing. And I told Santos, "I got to go down below, Santos, because I don't have a life jacket." And he said, "You can't." He said, "The ship is going down." I said, "I just came from the front of it." He said, the whole front end is gone." He said, "I said, what?" He said, "Oh, yeah." He says, "It's going to go." So I stayed with him. We both jumped off. When I hit the water, I hit something, and I thought I had hit Santos. And I thought I'd killed him, you know. So I didn't see Santos for 3 days. I had always thought I had knocked him out or something. But after 3 days, we met up with another group, and here he was. I found him there.
Well, those have to be the three longest days of your life. And this is one of the most incredible parts of this story. For more than 3 days, the Navy didn't know that you had sunk. Is that something that you've been able to make sense of since it happened?
I haven't. I've heard a lot of people talk about it, and then a lot of them say that there was a couple of ships that got an SOS, and they knew about it and stuff like that. But it's just one of those things, and I happen to be very lucky to have met later on the pilot that found us in the water. And we got pretty close, and I enjoyed meeting him afterwards. Everybody at the reunions, all the survivors there, they called him our angel. You know, he was the angel that happened to come by. And he just happened to be going by there. I mean, not looking for us or nothing. Another couple of days, and I don't think they'd have found anything. They'd have just found the oil slicks or something like that.
Well, and that was my next question, because obviously it was too late for quite a few, and they estimate that only about 300 of the 1,200 died when the ship was hit, and so then you have almost 900 men who are out in the water trying to survive, and if you're just trying to survive the conditions, that's bad enough. You got to stay hydrated, you have to stay afloat, but when you have sharks in the water killing people, I can't imagine what that was like for you. Did you see fellow sailors being eaten by sharks?
Yeah, that was kind of rough. I couldn't imagine myself. I mean, it was hard for me to, I stayed, I guess, I would say about 27 years without saying anything about it. I never talked to anybody about it.
Mm-hmm.
If they asked me something about it, I turn around and walk the other way. But nowadays, I have learned to cope with it, so I haven't been able to talk to people and stuff like that.
How did you survive, and how close did you come to having a shark take off a piece of you?
Well, I saw the shark coming around. I mean, everybody would, when they say sharks, they start kicking and all that stuff. And I kind of stayed in the middle of everything, and except when I found Santos Peña, I went around and went over to look for him. But otherwise, they had nets hanging on there, but the nets were very rough on you because the ocean was pretty rough. So on the nets, I would get in between the nets and swim with it. So that helped me quite a bit, too.
And I imagine the day that you were rescued in August of 1945 has to be the greatest day of your life, because none of the rest of the days would have happened if that day didn't happen. How did they get you out of there, and how great did that feel?
Kind of a dazed deal. I mean, because they come down with landing barges to pick you up with a hook, you know, and put you up in the landing barge. And then when they took you right up next to the ship that was going to put you in, which was the Bassett, the ocean was so rough that the landing barge was going up and down all the time. And so they had to put a kind of a hammock deal, you know, the deal that they put down, put you in there and tie you up, and then they haul you up to the top. I remember the sailors that took care of me. They were on this Bassett ship. Oh, they did a heck of a job. They gave me a little glass of water, probably about two swallows, and I told them, no. I said, one more? And no, you can't have it. So little by little, they got me back on.
They knew you couldn't handle that much. And I have to imagine you hadn't had anything to eat or drink for more than 3 days, right?
Oh, 4 days. Well, all the time I was there, I never had anything to eat or to drink.
So I imagine there had to be plenty of moments where you thought you were going to die.
I thought so.
How did you keep hope alive? I mean, were you out there praying? Were you trying to talk to other people?
Everybody was praying. I had my mother had gotten me a St. Anthony medal.
Mm-hmm.
And that medal that she gave me, I put it in my mouth.
Mm.
That medal stayed in my mouth all the time. I can remember that.
Well, clearly you feel blessed to have survived one of just a few more than 300 survivors of a ship of 1,200. But I want to get a sense of how tough it was for you to recover, because when your body goes through something like that, it does take a while to recover from those extreme circumstances. How long did it take you to get back to health?
About 4 months, three or four. I spent 3 months in Long Beach Naval Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays they call it something else, post symptoms or whatever.
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
In those days they called it, they said you were crazy or something like that. You know, they didn't bring up this the way they put it up now, you know.
I know you're often reminded about July 30th, 1945, the day the Indianapolis went down. When you think about all the men who lost their lives there, is there a way that you honor them, or their memory, or a way that you think they ought to be remembered?
When they asked me about young boys from Iraq coming in, which are 18, 19 years old, and I go back to them and I tell them, you know, in 1944, 45, when I was in the service, I say, these boys were only 18 or 19 years old. They were fighting in World War II. God, and they were fighters. God, I wouldn't. They fought a hell of a war, you know, in 1940. And they were young men. They were not. You'd figure that they were older men, but they weren't. To me, it's the best thing that has come out is the documentary that has come out. That's the closest that I've seen that has been the best telling of how the survivors came out of it and all that stuff. And she interviewed quite a few survivors. So she did a very good job on doing the documentary on that, you know. I remember when we first came out, when the war was over, there were very small little articles about it, you know, about the how many shipmates we had lost and stuff like that. But very small articles, and it wasn't very well known until most of these books started coming out, you know, Fatal Voyage and all those other ones that came in. And now that Sarah has come out with this documentary has been up in Europe and stuff like that, being shown and everything.
And I remember the first time that we spoke years ago, you said that there were parts of this that still came back to you and bothered you. Does that still happen to you?
It's been bothering me for all the time. I mean, this doesn't go away. I mean, the Veterans Administration has sent so many psychiatrists and everybody to come over and talk to me and everything. And everyone's tried to say that, tried to forget, tried to do that. And you can't do that. That comes to you almost every day. You can't go to bed at night and not think about it. I don't think I'll ever forget until they put me on the ground.
That moment would come for Harpo Salaya in December 2021. A post office in his native Florence, Arizona, is now named in his honor. The story of how he led Florence High School to a state basketball championship after surviving the sinking of the Indianapolis is one that should really be its own movie someday. Harpo was only 18 when the Indy sank, but he wasn't the youngest man aboard. That title went to Harold Bray, who just turned 99 and is now the final survivor of that final crew. A crew he joined in California after the Indy had come back to the States for repairs in the wake of a kamikaze attack off of Okinawa.
Being on that ship, and my first ship ever, big or small, sitting on a fantail and watching, we were doing 35 knots. I couldn't believe we were moving that fast. That big old, this thing is a big ship, doing 35 knots. It was a really experience for me. Of course, you couldn't even write home and tell about it because all your mail was special. I mean, everything. My mother would get a letter from me with everything crossed out. I couldn't tell her nothing. It was a big experience for me, but lucky to live through it.
Did you have a concept of the significance of the submarine threat and that you guys might be susceptible to that?
They didn't tell us too much, but they didn't want to scare us, I guess. Because they just come back from being hit.
So you guys get to Tinian, and you see them unload this precious cargo, this top-secret package?
Yeah. We didn't know what it was, though. We didn't know till we got in a hospital in the Philippines what we had, what we did.
And when you're leaving Tinian, as I understand it, McVeigh requested an escort and was denied?
And he refused.
Uh-huh.
Didn't need one.
Didn't need one because there shouldn't be any submarines where you're going.
Well, they figured we could outrun any sub. She was pretty fast.
Yeah.
But I didn't know a sub was around, so she shot us third day out of Tinian.
Typically, you would sleep below deck. But because it was so hot, they told you can sleep topside?
Yeah. That's where I slept on number two turret. I took a sleeping bag and a pillow, and I put it on top of the turret. And I remember it right. I took my shoes off and my clothes on. And when about midnight, a little after midnight, we got hit. And when the torpedoes hit right on the opposite side of the ship of me, and it rolled me off of that. I was like a 10-foot drop.
Mm-hmm.
And I seen my shoes go over the side. And I was, of course, I was dressed with dungarees on and sleeping on the open like that. And I got down on the quarterdeck, and it was just amazing. It seemed like we carried like 87 Marines. It seemed like they were all right there on the quarterdeck when I got down there. And they were starting to bail off. We were still on our way. I never got in the water till she was on her side. I was forward of the quarterdeck. I got down on the quarterdeck, and guys were going nuts. They were running all over the place. Some guys were hit. Some guys were bleeding. Some guys. I stopped at the quarterdeck just to get my bearings, and my shop was at the Fantail. I was a ship fitter. So I made my way back to. I went through the hangar deck, and I grabbed some kind of tools, and I headed back to the Fantail. On the way back, I grabbed a life jacket. The guy was throwing them out of a pocket, and I got back to the Fantail, and there were three guys laying up against the bulkhead. One guy was bleeding pretty bad, and I gave him my life jacket. I helped him up to the lifeline. I made sure that he jumped off right forward of the propellers. We got him over the side. Where we were on the Fantail, so she was laying on her side in the water. I went back and got another one. And all that time, she was keeling over. And by the time I got back to the Fantail, she was on her side. And instead of floating off, I climbed over the rail and ran down the side of the ship to the quarterdeck instead of floating off. And Fantail, I was going to stay dry as long as I could. When I went over the rail, I had to run forward to get away from the shafts. Screws were still turning. So I ran to the quarterdeck, and that's where most of the guys were piling off there. They're all gathered there, but she was going down fast. And so I got in the water. And when I hit the water, somebody hit me and drove me down. I opened my eyes up in the water, and I could see the guys, the lights. And, of course, stupid me opened my eyes in the salt water. That was not the thing to do. But I hit the surface, and when I come to the surface, I looked back, and she was up on her bow. She was halfway sunk already. Mm-hmm. And the guys were still coming off. And I swam away from her. I was kind of pulled, and I swam away from her and got on a raft. One guy was on it. We had a raft. So we picked up, I think we picked up 80 guys that night. And then, of course, we had a crash net, and we tied it to the raft. And so the guys would hang on to something. And, of course, as the days go on, the guys got sick or died from wounds they had. And I came through it pretty good. I got my whole side was burned on my left side. But other than that, it was okay. But the guys were hurt pretty bad.
It's time for our final break, but we'll hear more of Harold Bray's story when we come back. 81 years after that tragic sinking, he stands as the last survivor to tell that story. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing on the eternal legacy of the USS Indianapolis as we mark the 81st anniversary of its sinking. The story continues to grow as more and more research is done and more time passes, from the posthumous exoneration of the ship's captain to an important development in recent years with the publishing of the book Heroes in the Shadows about the African-American members of the Indy's final crew, all of whom died in the sinking. The final survivor, Harold Bray, recently turned 99 in Benicia, California, or Benicia, as he likes to say it, He was a police officer there for decades, but 81 years ago this week, he was an 18-year-old new member of the cruiser's crew. And the night of July 29th, 1945, was the first time he had ever decided to skip sleeping in his quarters and go up on the deck instead, a decision that almost certainly saved his life.
Yeah, that's right. My deck was three decks down, next to sick bay. My bunk was here. There was a stack of three bunks, and I was on the top bunk. The sick bay was right there. So.
And isn't that about where the torpedo hit?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it hit right, blew sick bay out of there.
If this were the night before,
yeah,
when you were sleeping down there, or if you hadn't decided to go topside that night, you wouldn't have made it out of there.
No, I don't know why. Well, because it's so hot.
Yeah.
And decided to sleep up on top of a steel deck rather than in my bunk. That was kind of stupid, but it saved my life. If I was in my bunk area, I would have been killed right there. I would never made it out.
And another thing I read about your experience, I think it might have been in Sarah Vladek and Lynn Vincent's book when they talk about your story, that before you abandoned ship, that I think it was Frenchie said to you, the ship's going down, and you couldn't believe it.
Yeah, Frenchie told me, you better get going, Bray. She's going down. I said, where's it going to go? Where's it going to go?
You had never considered that possibility.
Yeah.
That this beautiful ship could sink.
And at that point, we didn't know how bad she was hit, but she had taken two torpedoes, midship, one forward and one midship. But she was still upright. But then the water came and started listing right away. When I went in the water, she was on her side. Of course, when I hit the water, somebody drove me down about 30, 40 feet. It seemed like I was never going to get back up there.
Well, and when you did, I think you found it wasn't all just water, right? There's a lot of oil in the water.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was about like 4 inches. Well, I had oil in my eyes, my ears, everything. It was a ruptured oil tank or something when we got hit.
I'm just trying to imagine what goes through the mind of an 18-year-old who is woken up by a torpedo hitting his ship, who falls to the next deck, whose shoes go overboard, who then he's going overboard, and now you're in the water in the dark, not knowing what's going on. What in the world were you thinking?
I don't know. I thought the Navy did that to everybody.
You and hundreds of other sailors aboard the Indianapolis are watching that ship go down. And you're in the water. Looking back now, you know what you went through over the 4 or 5 days that followed. But at that point, as you grab onto this raft and other guys are coming alongside, did you guys think you were going to be rescued? Was there any talk of what's going to happen next?
No, we didn't. Of course, we're by ourselves. No escort. We wondered about that, but they said, well, your ship was so fast it didn't need an escort. We were the fastest ship in the fleet at the time. But that was kind of ridiculous, even. Most every ship had a destroyer with them, and we were by ourselves, and that was a big mistake, hindsight, you know.
And I'm guessing that you all would assume the ship was able to send out an SOS, a distress call.
Well, it would have, but CIC was hit, and it was just shut everything down. We didn't even get an abandoned ship.
But you guys in the water don't know that.
No.
So the reality is you've sunk, and no one in the Navy knows about it.
No. We're by ourselves.
And this would be just the first night, really just the morning, till the sun came up. Did that feel like it was days or weeks or years? I mean, what did that feel like as a teenager going through that?
I don't know. I thought Navy did that to everybody.
Breaking you in.
Yeah. I don't know what my thoughts were. I know it was kind of I don't remember even getting scared when we got hit. It seemed like I knew what to do, but nobody ever told me what to do.
And you're injured. You're burned?
Yeah. My whole left side was, my clothes were gone. I didn't blister much. My arm was blistered, my left, but it was all on my left side. But that salt water didn't do it any good.
So how much pain were you in?
But it burns, you know, until it scabbed over and it was couple of days. The salt water was no fun to be in with open sores.
Well, especially when there are sharks in the vicinity too.
Yeah.
And I just want everybody to understand the situation. So you're burned, you're covered in oil, you have no food, no water?
No. No. Well, the oil kind of protected you from the sun because we were oil from head to toe, in eyes and mouth, tongue. Still taste it to this day. Oof. It was, you didn't have enough sense to close your mouth when you hit the water. I drank about a half a quart of oil, I think. But then you start throwing up, and after that's over, you're okay. But being just out of boot camp, you know, didn't expect anything like that.
And you mentioned, you know, more time that goes by, more guys latch on to this raft with the net attached, floating there. Did you guys talk to each other much?
Well, I don't remember what we talked about, but you didn't know anybody. I went on board with 10 other guys, and they weren't in that group I was in. We got split up in the water, three groups, and we were the biggest group, I guess. We I don't know how many guys. We ended up with 80 guys in our, but when we got picked up, there was 18 of us 5 days later.
Well, and the tragic reality of the Indianapolis is that even though 900 of the almost 1,200 survived the sinking, by the time you're picked up almost 5 days later, there's only 316 of you still alive.
Yeah.
So we know that over those days, there are a lot of things that were happening to claim these lives. What was your first awareness that sharks were in the area?
Oh, the guys were getting hit. The guys that were bleeding, sharks were taking them first. But you weren't exempted. If you're on the outer edge of this group, I think we counted off the first morning, we were 80 of us. And then with this group, we had a crash net, you know what a floater net is?
Yeah.
We had one of those and a raft. We tied it together. They had something to hang on to because even with a Pecaut life jacket, it was only good for so many hours, you know.
I think it was like 3 days, right? 72 hours or something?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And you had to have somebody or something to hang on to because we were in the water for over 100 hours. So I don't know what kept me alive, but I came through it pretty good shot, except for the burns. That was okay. There were flash burns. There weren't deep burns. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of guys are a lot worse than me.
So you're 18 years old. You're burned. You're covered in oil. No food, no water. And now you're seeing other guys eaten by sharks right in front of your eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And the sharks had to come close to you, too.
Oh, so I got hit a couple times. Once I got bumped in the rib cage. I thought he had me that time. But their face is so pointed. He just bumped me to see if I was still alive or something. And swam off. But that was the closest it came. But it was pretty, pretty scary because guys were getting hit all the time. If you're any kind of wound and you're bleeding, you're just shark bait as well.
Well, and sharks weren't the only reason that guys died. Can you give us some other examples of what you saw happening that prevented some of those other sailors from surviving?
Well, the burns, some guys were really burned pretty bad. And then, of course, drinking that salt water, go crazy. And they never taught us anything in boot camp about that, you know. Of course, I was out of boot camp a couple of months before I got on a ship. They never talked about, because she just got back from the war zone, and she just repaired. She was taken pretty hard at Okinawa. She took a couple good hits there. That's when I got on her, when she got back from there. Then we went right back out there and got hit again.
So some of the guys around you, even on your raft, because you had no fresh water,
no,
and you're getting pounded by the sun while it's up, some guys resorted to drinking that salt water.
Oh, yeah.
And then they'd have hallucinations and maybe just go under or swim to some vision.
A lot of the guys just attack other guys, you know. They went crazy. And I just had enough sense to stay away from them. I don't know what made me do this, but I stayed by myself most of the time. Matter of fact, I swam away from the group and got a raft by myself for one day. And then I started picking up survivors, and they were just hanging on to each other.
As I just imagine, and it's really impossible for us to imagine going through this, because except for you guys, no one's gone through something this insane.
Yeah.
But I would imagine that initially, the first night, the first couple days maybe even, there's a fair amount of hope that someone's going to find you guys?
Yeah, I don't know if we had any radio guys in our group or not, but they got a radio message off. But never was one, I don't think. We had airplanes go over every day, and they were way too high. And to the last day in the water, I was looking to the horizon, and seen this airplane just come, like it just came up like this out of the horizon and came right at us. And it wasn't looking for us. Flew right over us, and then we was screaming and splashing in the water, and they saw us, give us the wing thing. And he came back and did it again, and I seen him go straight up, and that's when he radioed what he had. And, of course, it was another day and a half before we got rescued, but we knew somebody knew where we were. But other than that, nobody knew where we got hit. Then they took us off the board in the Philippines, thinking they were already in there. We're supposed to report in, but I guess somebody messed up and took us off the board and didn't know where we were. Just a stroke of luck that we ever discovered. He just seen us by accident. He wasn't even looking for us.
What did you say to him the first time you got to meet him?
I think I kissed him. I don't know.
Is there any doubt in your mind whether or not you'd be alive if he didn't see you?
Because we were in the water 4 days already. Nobody saw us. If they did, they ignored us. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was, when we first hit the water, there was like 1,100 of us in the water. If you were hurt, you weren't lasting, but it just died off every day. We were burying guys, and it was not a good sight to even think about, you know. It was quite an experience.
The plane comes over, so you know you've been spotted. But then it's another day and a half before they come back.
Yeah.
Seems like that might be the longest part of the whole thing.
Yeah. It was, where are they? Where are they? They never here. Where are they? Of course, we were like 200 miles off of land, any land. So a ship even traveling at 6 knots takes a while to cover 200 miles. And at one point, there were 6 ships. Came to the rescue, and the Bassett was one I got on. She was the first one there. And see, when I got picked up, I was by myself.
Well, and the reason you were by yourself, I think, is because you saw them drop something from the plane. They dropped a sono buoy, but you thought it was water.
Yeah, I hung on to that till I got on a raft by myself. When they picked us up, I was sleeping and I was hanging on to whatever it was. I was tired. I was in the water 4 days already.
And you hadn't had anything to eat or drink?
No.
Nothing?
Nothing.
How much weight did you lose?
35 pounds or less.
In 5 days?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you must not have had much strength left when they're trying to pick you up.
No, I couldn't even lift my arms out of the water. They were there for a long time.
Can you describe for us what that feels like? With everything that you'd been through, when you finally are put on that LCVP going back to the Bassett, and you know, for the first time, you're actually going to live. What did that feel like?
Probably I was happy. It was just a miracle that anybody even found us. I don't think he was high enough to see us, but he seen the oil slick. We were in the oil, and that's how we got discovered.
He thought maybe he'd find a Japanese submarine to shoot at or something.
I guess that was what he said, yeah.
Was there ever a point in those 5 days where you thought about giving up?
I practically did. I was getting tired. Of course, there was more room on the raft by that time. You know, it was not a raft. It was a rope.
A rope net that you could get on top of and sit.
But you're still in the water up to your neck, holding your head up.
But you don't have to actively hold on with your arms anymore.
You're hanging on to each other until everybody was gone, you know. Just lucky. Just the guys that lived through it was just lucky.
And they took you to the hospital in the Philippines, I believe?
Samar, yeah.
How long did it take you to recover?
Oh, I don't know. They flew us. They took us to the hospital out of the Philippines and flew us to a hospital in Guam. So we were in Guam maybe a month and a half. I remember hospital 18. I'll never forget that. Then they went from there to San Diego. Spent some time in a hospital there. I was based at an air base in Detroit after that.
But it was while you were in the hospital, I think, that you first learned, hey, that crate that we took to Tinian, that was the atomic bomb that pretty much ended the war.
Yeah.
Was that kind of an eye-opening realization that that's what it was?
Well, nobody knew about the skipper didn't even know.
Yeah.
It's kept big secret till they dropped it.
And speaking of the skipper, because there was such a great loss of life on your ship, it was such a disaster. So many things went wrong. People were looking for someone to blame.
Yeah, well, he took the blame. he committed suicide for that reason, I guess, because he was getting nasty letters from the mothers and dads, and we would have got hit no matter what. It was they were just out looking for us. I got to know them.
Yeah. And in fact, the commander of that Japanese submarine, I-58, Hashimoto, even came to the U.S. to testify in the court-martial that I would have gotten him whether he zigzagged or not.
Yeah.
And they still convicted him.
Yeah.
So you and your fellow survivors are living with that, bothered by that. He commits suicide in the 60s. And then in the 90s, a 12-year-old, I believe he was a 12-year-old kid in Florida, Hunter Scott, gets into this story and gets the Senate's attention. And they finally retry this case, basically, in Congress and clear his name, exonerate him.
Yeah.
What did that mean to you and your fellow survivors?
Well, finally got it right, you know. No matter what, we were just in a position where we were going to get hit no matter what. It was no accident the Japs were out looking for us. So I just so lucky because no sleeping where I was supposed to be sleeping. That's where the two torpedoes hit.
Yeah.
And I happened to be sleeping three decks higher. Just a matter of luck.
There's a lot of what-ifs in your story.
Yeah.
How do you explain them all?
Just a matter of luck. That's all I can say. Oh, she's waving her head. Things to do.
Your wife believes that God was protecting you so she could marry you someday.
Yeah, that's what she says, yeah. It was just a matter of luck. They weren't even looking for us. I can see it today coming over the horizon, coming right at us. When he came over, I can see him do his wings. And he went out and came back, did it again, and he went straight up. That's when he radioed what he had. But he was our angel ever since. And as a matter of fact, that's what we called him, the angel. Because if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't be talking. It was amazing going through that. I don't know how anybody ever lived through it. It was the weather saved us because we didn't have any rough weather, and most of us were hurt. If we had any storms, I don't think it would have lived through it. Mm-hmm. But we had pretty good weather for 4 days. A matter of fact, the night we got picked up, I think we hit some rough weather. I got picked up at 1, a little bit after 1 o'clock in the morning, I was picked up. And I think I was the first one aboard the Bassett.
Again, just trying to imagine myself in your shoes. You're 18 when this all happens. So you've lived with that experience in mind.
Never leaves.
How has that impacted the way you've lived your life since?
Just appreciate what I had. Because we lost 880 guys that never had that chance. Whoever got in the water, if they were hurt, they didn't live very long. And all they had was burns on my left side. I wasn't hurt very bad, but there was guys in some bad shape. No matter what they do, you'll never can imagine what we went through while in the water. I can't even tell you what it was like. Nobody should go through stuff like that. You're dodging sharks, and then you're dodging guys that are going nuts, attacking you. I'm telling you, I'm just so lucky to get through that.
And still ticking at 99 in Benicia, California, where a larger-than-life statue of Harold Bray is something you should visit the next time you're in the Bay Area. I'll say it again. Go to ussindianapolis.com to explore this ever-expanding story even further. And thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.